From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The first modern outdoor pro hockey game in the U.S. took place on Tuesday, but will the Winter Classic help the NHL shake off its post-lockout big chill? Ahead on Only a Game, a report from Buffalo. Also, a look at the life of former NBA star George Mikan and at the slowly dying Minnesota Timberwolves, the woeful expansion team Mikan wanted to help build. Also ahead, trade school table hockey and the trash talk it inspires among aspiring bookbinders, jewelers, preservation carpenters, and violin makers.
Trim his button, ream out his peg holes, gouge out his eyes. That one's a good one.
Wait, do you actually gouge out eyes?
Yeah, the eyes on the scroll. You could use a knife too, so knife out his eyes would be just as gruesome.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. If your teams came up short in the Roadies Humanitarian Bowl, the Brute Sun Bowl, the AutoZone Liberty Bowl, and the 26 other bowl games that have already transpired, perhaps you can get well with picks in the International Bowl and the GMAC Bowl, assuming Bookie Bob is still taking your calls. Or perhaps you'll elect to take today and tomorrow off and then bet your entire future on the All-State BCS Championship game on Monday night. Joining me now, for entertainment purposes only, I assure you, to offer advice regarding those alternatives is Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports. Dan, what's your one lost record against the spread at this point?
Gambling's illegal.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
You know, I don't live in Las Vegas, so I wouldn't even know what you're talking about.
All right, then. On the strength of 17 points off of turnovers, number 8 Kansas defeated number 5 Virginia Tech 24-21 in Thursday's Orange Bowl. Jayhawks, next college football power?
Probably not a power, but they certainly have built their way up to a very good program. And they have a coach in Mark Mangino who it took a long time to become a head coach because of his looks, I think, and his weight. But his ability to motivate and think the game is clearly as good as anyone's because Kansas has never been this good. So a very interesting sort of side story on how there's sort of a stereotype against a guy, even in football, where big people are the norm.
On Wednesday, West Virginia routed favored Oklahoma 48-28. It seems like then interim coach Bill Stewart made a pretty good case to make him the de facto head coach of the Mountaineers.
He got the job.
Yep.
This is usually a terrible way to hire a coach. History says the interim guy who wins usually ends up failing, and athletic directors and presidents of schools get swept up in the excitement of the one victory, and the guy proves himself. Generally not a good system. We will see in this case with West Virginia, but it was a great moment for the Mountaineers to really put together a great season.
Of course, all coaches fail eventually.
Yeah, well, they usually fail quickly.
USC beat Illinois by 32 points in the Rose Bowl. Georgia throttled Hawaii by 31 in the Sugar Bowl. Hawaii hadn't lost until that game. There have been smaller bowls that have thrilled the 37 people watching them on TV, but the BCS bowls have been largely duds. I thought the BCS formula was supposed to end all boring postseason college football. What happened?
Oh, no, Bill. It's supposed to make as much money as possible.
Oh, I was misinformed.
I don't know where you got the idea of entertainment value or fairness to the kids or competitive interests. This is absolutely ridiculous to think such a thing. The BCS games have been terrible for the most part because they are designed to be terrible in a lot of ways. It's more important for the powers that be, the commissioners of these conferences, to protect their revenue streams and political ties than to actually give good games. The idea of having USC and Georgia play each other in, say, the Rose Bowl made sense to every fan because these were probably the two best non-championship game teams. But in the eyes of the BCS commissioners, you don't want to have those two play each other because if one of them blows the other one out, so let's say USC had beaten Georgia by 40 points, the cries would be USC should be the number one team in the country. That would take away from their main game. So on purpose, they provided essentially mismatches in those games, and they succeeded, as they usually do.
Associate producer Gabe O'Connor shouted obscenities at invisible people for two solid weeks after number 6 Missouri was shut out of the BCS Bowls. And on New Year's Day, the Tigers crushed Arkansas in the Cotton Bowl 38-7. Will the NCAA convince bowl committees to drop the old conference tie-ins in favor of better matchups, or does your previous argument just make that entirely unlikely?
Yeah, what you got to understand is the Big Ten and the Pac-10 don't just play in the Rose Bowl. They're on the board of directors of the Rose Bowl. This is nothing to do with good games. This is nothing to do with competitive fairness. It's all about money and politics and power. And so that's kind of the problem. Every football fan in the country is frustrated with this system. But you just have this establishment built-in money and power that they just can't wrest it from yet.
Look, Dan, money, politics, and power. People listen to Only a Game because they're tired of talk about who should be president. So let's just get back to football.
The Iowa caucus makes far more sense than this. College football would love a system as convoluted as the Iowa caucus.
Well, all right, let's get right to the big game. Tonight in Toronto, the International Bowl, who you got?
Is that the Ball State game?
Yeah, Ball State.
I'll take Rutgers in that one.
The BCS championship game, of course, is on Monday. That features Ohio State, which hasn't played in almost 2 months, and Louisiana State, the first two-loss team to make the BCS title game. Is this the proper way to end what has arguably been the strangest college football season ever, given all the upsets?
I'm thinking that is not the script that Fox will use to hype, the game tonight.
All right, so which team wins?
I think LSU will win because their defense, which was dominant early in the season and then suffered a number of injuries, is pretty much healthy again. And I think their defense is going to be back in form. And so if the defense is healthy, they have the ability to maximize their game at a higher level than Ohio State. So I think LSU is a better team if they play really well than Ohio State is. So I think LSU will win the game.
Dan Wetzel covers college football for Yahoo Sports. Dan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Always entertaining.
The National Hockey League rang in the new year with its highly promoted Winter Classic outdoor hockey game. The throwback duel between the Buffalo Sabres and the Pittsburgh Penguins attracted a sellout crowd to the home of the NFL's Buffalo Bills after Ralph Wilson Stadium was converted to a hockey rink for New Year's Day. The floundering league hopes that its marketing bet will also pay off in the long run. Joyce Kryzak of member station WBFO in Buffalo was there, and she has our story.
The Winter Classic fairy tale began when the NHL announced the long-rumored game on a hot day in early September. The league got its wish, and that day looked nothing like game day 4 months later. Huge soft flakes swirled around players in retro jerseys as they raced across the glassy ice. All that was needed to complete the picture-perfect snow globe event was to add excited fans and shake.
I can't even say. It's unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it in my life. It's unbelievable. It truly is. 70,000 people sitting in the freezing cold watching people play hockey. It's amazing. It truly is amazing.
Longtime Sabres fan Kelly Moore was certainly not alone in her amazement of the event. There were actually more than 71,000 people on hand to watch old-fashioned pond hockey. They came from several states away, Canada, and even across the Big Pond to see the first NHL outdoor game played in the U.S. But one slight change in the weather could have turned all this magic into mush. Only one day before the game, workers went into overtime to provide what a fickle Mother Nature might decide not to. It was Tom Boyd's job to spread tons of the fluffy white stuff around the boards to guarantee that beautiful winter effect.
20 truckloads, I think, of snow in here. Here in Buffalo, we have to actually truck snow in for a game, but it's kind of funny.
But by game day morning, it was a brisk 31 degrees and another few inches fell, quite naturally, to complete the winter wonderland scene. But league officials were concerned about more than image and luring new fans to the lagging sport. Ice conditions needed to be near perfect so that players didn't get hurt and the game didn't turn into a marketing fiasco. The league had only a week to set up this regulation ice rink on football turf. It was painstakingly assembled with layer upon layer of styrofoam, plywood, plastic mats, coolant, and of course, water. According to players, after a pregame practice, the end product was pretty darn close to the real indoor manufactured stuff. Sabres forward Thomas Vanek wishes he could play on it once a week.
You know, the way it looks and everything, I was, you know, really surprised by it. You know, I didn't know what to think of it. And, you know, now skating out there, I feel like it's a great thing, and hopefully there's more to come.
On game day, fans shared his enthusiasm. That included future hockey star, 10-year-old Killian Humpart-Zumia.
It's awesome. I play travel hockey, and it is sweet. It's going to be great. Great matchup. And the Penguins are wearing those throwback jerseys. They're pretty cool.
Holding more so-called Ice Bowl events is something the NHL is considering to boost interest in the game. Two lockouts, a new collective bargaining agreement, and rule changes designed to make hockey more entertaining haven't netted the larger fan base the league needs to thrive. John Collins is the NHL's vice president for business and media. He says an outdoor game, possibly every year, is just one of many things they need to do.
We need to begin to create some sort of scale to the league, as opposed to just relying on the local passion that our fans have for their clubs. We need to give national advertisers a roadmap for how to activate against this audience, you know, and that's what these kind of events do.
Initial ratings show the nationally televised Winter Classic drew higher ratings than any regular NHL season game in more than a decade. That was good news for the league and its advertisers. And it was good news for concessionaires at the game. Concessionaire Jim Sobey says the souvenirs went fast.
Sales are going excellent today. We're doing very, very well. We're almost sold out of everything. There won't be anything left in a stadium in merchandise when we're done.
Officials estimate more than $1 million worth of memorabilia was sold on game day alone. That doesn't include future DVD sales of the NBC broadcast. And there are sure to be plenty because the game ended in a shootout, matching Sabre star goalie Ryan Miller against the NHL's biggest star, Sidney Crosby.
The game on his stick right here. Score! Penguins win!
After the Penguins' 2-1 victory, Crosby said the whole experience was unforgettable.
You know, for me growing up, I played a lot outside. I think a lot of other guys did too, and it brings you back a bit. And when you see 70,000 people jammed into a stadium to watch hockey, it's usually a good sign. So the atmosphere and the environment, I don't think you can beat that. And I think it's just something we'll all look back and say we had a lot of great memories of being part of it.
But some critics have called the event nothing more than a marketing stunt, and they've questioned the long-term impact. Sabres coach Lindy Ruff says the Winter Classic brought hockey back to its roots, and he says that's got to be good for the game.
You know, it may not be the best hockey game because of the situation, because of the weather, because of the snow, but the atmosphere was incredible. It was incredible. And to hell with the cynics.
Even before he finished talking, the ice was being chipped up and taken away from Ralph Wilson Stadium. But if you listened carefully, the roar of the crowd seemed frozen in time. For Only a Game, I'm Joyce Kryzak in Buffalo.
It's 19 minutes past the hour.
You hit it left, you hit it right.
Frustrating as golf can be, the golf ball is rarely thought of as deadly, but a 32-inch carpet python in New South Wales, Australia, recently almost succumbed to death by golf ball. Actually, golf balls. It seems that a couple had placed four of the spheroids in their chicken coop, hoping thereby to encourage a reluctant hen to nest. The next morning, they discovered the bloated python, which had mistaken the golf balls for eggs. The couple took the python to veterinarian Michael Pine, who surgically removed the golf balls and said they were stuck where they were. If the snake hadn't been found, it would have died for sure.
The pros don't have these problems. They look so debonair. You never see them tear.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, the life of former NBA star George Mikan. But first, the bad news for the Minnesota Timberwolves is that they lost last night to the Denver Nuggets, dropping the team to 4-28. The T-Wolves own the worst record in the NBA. The good news? Well, I may need some help with that one, so I'm joined now on the line by Jerry Zagoda, who covers the Wolves for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Jerry, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much.
I'll try a multiple-choice question. The Timberwolves' woeful state is the fault of A, general manager Kevin McHale, B, owner Glenn Taylor, C, naughty North Star basketball imps, D, all of the above, E, none of the above, F, some of the above.
Can I go with imps? I like that answer.
Ah, good. Yeah, that was my favorite among those choices as well.
Well, the first two questions would actually stir a great debate among people here, the fans that are left. Most of whom absolutely hate Kevin McHale and call him McPhail and all those sorts of things, and you know, want him to be fired. And then the other side of it is people who hold Taylor more accountable because he's remained so loyal to him. Mm-hmm. So they've made a series after series of bad moves. One, signing a secret deal with Joe Smith in 1999 that was later found out and cost them a whole slew of draft choices and a variety of other things. Ultimately, I guess we'd have to say McHale, but people also have lost their patience with Taylor for sticking with him for so long.
Well, since the deal this summer between Boston and Minnesota that involved the swap of 10-time All-Star Kevin Garnett for Al Jefferson and a bag of several extremely shiny doorknobs, the Celtics have won at the rate of 9 games out of 10. The Wolves have lost at about the same clip. How does Kevin McHale keep his job?
It's a good question. Glenn Taylor's a loyal guy, and I think he's still, you know, from when he bought the team in 94, and that was when Kevin was retired a few years from the Celtics and doing TV for the Wolves, and he hired him, and, you know, I think he's still a little bit smitten with his great playing career, and I'm not sure how he runs his other businesses, but in this case, he's extremely loyal.
Minnesota fans were fed up with the team even when the Timberwolves made the playoffs. What are people saying now that there's very little hope of making anything this year?
I think generally it's mostly apathy. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things to do in this town. There's a lot of other options. They're intrigued by Al Jefferson, and we're back to the early – I covered the team the first 5 years. We're back to those early years where we're waiting for lottery balls to bounce and starting to talk about Derrick Rose and Michael Beasley.
Minnesota has been known in the past as a strong hockey and football state. The Twins, of course, are beloved, at least when they're going well. Is there room for pro basketball there, or was that idea doomed from the start?
Well, I think there is. I mean, the Lakers won 50 years ago, but times change and things move on. You know, I think if things had turned out a little bit different, if they had made different decisions, I think the most intriguing thing was if what would have happened if they drafted Garnett in 95. The next year they made a deal and drafted, traded Ray Allen and got the rights to Stephon Marbury. And if he had stayed here, I think history may have looked completely different. He wanted out after 3 years. I think part of that was attributed to you know, Garnett holding out and getting a $126 million contract that shut the league down and kind of rewrote all the salary cap rules. And Garnett was grandfathered in, and nobody could make that amount of money after that. And I don't think Marbury's ego could take it, and ended up he thought it would be better to go to, you know, someplace else. He went to New Jersey, then Phoenix and New York, and has never really had much of a career. And I think Garnett's career also was affected. Those two guys that stayed together, they might have been kind of a Stockton Malone for a decade or more. And I think this team would have had a great deal of playoff success.
Jerry Zagoda covers the Minnesota Timberwolves beat for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and he joined me on the line from Minneapolis. Jerry, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. You might just make it after all. You might just make it after all. For most of his 9-year career in pro basketball, George Mikan, who retired in 1956, was the game's most dominant player. In a new biography titled Mr. Basketball, Michael Schumacher tells the story of George Mikan, of whom Shaquille O'Neal has said, "Without George Mikan, there'd be no me." Michael Schumacher joins me now from WHAD in Milwaukee. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks very much for having me.
George Mikan was 6 feet 10 inches tall and he weighed 240 pounds. How unusual was a player that size when he began playing at DePaul University?
It was very unusual. Nowadays, of course, 6'10 puts you just about in the middle, it seems, in basketball. But back in those days, you know, anything much more than 6'6", 6'7", was considered really like a freak. And Mikan, in fact, was very, very sensitive about being called a freak or a goon or something like that. Other teams would use those terms to bait him, and it usually worked.
Yeah, he was baitable. Yes. That could be said of George Mikan.
And Mikan, you know, he would get a little sensitive about it. They'd ask him the usual silly questions, such as, "How's the weather up there?" And George would spit on the ground and say, "It's raining."
One of the advantages that George Mikan had as a college player is not available to college or pro players today. What were the restrictions in the 1940s on blocking shots?
They created, because of Bob Curlin and George Mikan and a player named Don Otten, who played for Bowling Green, the goaltending rules that you're seeing today. Back then, he could pretty much block anything he wanted, ball coming up, ball going down, ball in the cylinder, anywhere you wanted it to be, he can swat it away. And they actually would devise defenses for that purpose. The big guy just sat underneath and waited for the shot to go up, and his job wasn't to score, as it became later on. It was to knock the ball away or for jump balls. One of the things you were talking about before, about the rules and the differences, there used to be a jump ball after free throws. And so you wanted a big guy on the team that could, you know, get you the ball back after a free throw. And so that's what these big guys did then. And they were nowhere near, you know, what you're looking at today in terms of height. Mikan was a big guy. I mean, he was a midget, you know, next to Shaquille O'Neal.
When George Mikan finished playing at DePaul, what did the landscape of pro basketball look like?
It was really interesting to me. This was one of the better parts for me as far as the research is concerned in this book, was researching that era, because it was interesting that you had companies, the Chicago American Gear Company, for example, the Fort Wayne Zollner Pistons. Mm-hmm. The teams were owned by companies, and you worked for that company. In Mikan's case, he was going to be a lawyer for this company, but there were other guys, a guy named Dick Tripto, who I talked to, worked right there in the plant. And then you would play basketball as well for the team. Can you imagine trying to do that today, incidentally? Imagine Tracy McGrady working for, I don't know, for anybody other than the Houston Rockets. But it was just a love of the game that kept these people doing it. Very few earned a living playing pro basketball. A few, Mikan amongst them, did. But the others all had regular jobs, you know, that they had in the off season, or they went to the company that they worked for, the Pistons, for example, or the Gears, or whoever was sponsoring them. There were tennis shoe companies, there were tire companies, all kinds of people that sponsored these teams that became the forerunners to the National Basketball Association.
There's a famous photo of George Mikan as a Minneapolis Laker polishing the letters on the Madison Square Garden marquee, and the marquee reads, "George Mikan versus New York Knicks." To what extent was Mikan the reason people paid attention to pro basketball in the late 40s and early 50s?
He was largely the reason. Mikan was the superstar. He was like Michael Jordan all those years later, where people, no matter where they lived, they knew the name, they knew the face, and they came to see George Mikan. The Knicks normally played at the Armory. They very rarely played at Madison Square Garden, maybe a third of their games. And this was a big game for them, and it was the only game they were going to be playing the Lakers at the Garden that particular season. As I mentioned in the book, it was a very funny episode where they decided to play a trick on Mikan. And Slater Martin, who's kind of he's a Hall of Fame guard, one of the really greats of the early days of basketball, he conned the whole team into not dressing for the game. When Mikan went through his routine of getting dressed for a game, he'd take off his glasses. He was virtually blind without those glasses. He said it was like trying to look through a windshield in a rainstorm without windshield wipers. So he's dressing and he's getting himself ready to go, and everybody else is kind of sitting around, not getting dressed. They're talking in a locker room, and when Mike can put his glasses back on, he looks around and says, "Guys, well, you know, we got a game to play. What's going on?" And Slater Martin says something along the line, "We don't have a game. It says out there, George Mikan versus the Knicks. Go get him, George. Good luck to you."
George Mikan died in 2005, and toward the end of his life, he became very involved in the attempt to get pension benefits for the players of his generation. Was he an effective force in that effort?
Well, they haven't succeeded yet, so effective is really going to be a matter of definition. George Mikan's presence was very important in making people aware of the inequity that you see in the what they call the pre-65ers and the post-65ers. In 1965, they set up the pension that, to a large extent, you're looking at today. Anybody who played before that wasn't getting anywhere near what these other players are getting. You can say what you want about today's players and their athleticism and their abilities and so forth, which really are much, much greater than you saw in the early days. But if it hadn't been for those pioneers, the people of the George Mikans, the Bob Cousys, the Bill Russells, and so forth, you know, these people wouldn't be collecting money today. So they deserve to be rewarded, and in some cases, they weren't being rewarded. And so Mikan campaigned really hard, and he was effective. To get back to your question, he was effective in the respect that he didn't get hot-headed about it. He worked well with the commissioner. I can't imagine what's going through David Stern's mind when the simple fact of the matter is that if you took the money that they collect in fines from people misbehaving in the National Basketball Association on any given year, you would be able to pay every single one of the guys that are excluded today. You have people who are living in very desperate situations in some respects who are getting nothing but the cold shoulder from the National Basketball Association, and David Stern and all the others ought to be ashamed of themselves for it.
Well, George Mikan was one of the guys who really could have used some help the last few years of his life.
Yes. He literally had to sell all of his trophies and his memorabilia to pay medical expenses. His diabetes had cost him one leg. Had he lived, it would have cost him the other. Mm. He'd lost all the toes on one of his, the one foot he did have, a couple fingers, and he had to go in for dialysis three times a week. And he tried his best to do what he could do with in terms of signings, you know, and appearances and so forth. And when that wasn't enough, he sold everything that meant anything to him to pay his debts. And in the end, when this man dies, Shaquille O'Neal ends up paying for his funeral because his family just did not have any money.
Michael Schumacher is the author of Mr. Basketball, George Mikan, the Minneapolis Lakers, and the Birth of the NBA, published by Bloomsbury. He joined me from the studios of WHAD in Milwaukee. Michael, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Only a Game. John Price, who hears Only a Game on Vermont Public Radio, took issue with one of the stories on our Best Of show last week, of the story about the ex-husband and wife demolition derby. He wrote, "It was in such poor, I would even say reprehensible taste, pandering to the always sad resentment, pain, and rage of divorced former couples, that I had to switch off my radio in disgust. What were you thinking?" A WBUR listener named Zach was dismayed by Karen Given's story about the Navy SEALs' Trident Challenge, which also reran last week. "Consider what the purpose of the SEALs is," he wrote, "to do things like kidnap and assassinate outside the normal rules of warfare and totally outside any judicial review." David Bucher, who hears the program on WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, complained this week about noxious ear pollution. "Your poetry interludes are the worst," he wrote. "When you start, I run screaming from the room." "Well, Mr. Bucher, you run, you say, when I come on. Perhaps you'd like a tape. My verse, such as it is, might help you get yourself in shape." Katie Stover, who hears the program on KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri, wrote to defend Charlie Pierce against a previous listener's charge that Charlie's nastiness had made the listener swear off not just Only a Game, but public radio. "Sorry, honey," Ms. Stover wrote. "Like any good umpire, Charlie's calling him as he sees him, and I'm going to double my contribution to KCUR to make sure you do stay on the air." Mary Moss Sprague, who hears the program on WRVO in New York, was among the listeners delighted by our reworking of the Barry Bonds story in the manner of It's a Wonderful Life. "I was attempting to fry some eggs for breakfast," she wrote. "The fried egg plan quickly changed to scrambled because I was laughing so hard I couldn't control the spatula. What a funny skit. It beats the original movie hands down. Keep up the hilarious humor so adroitly combined with thought-provoking social commentary." Let us know what you think of the program by writing us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can also reach us through the website, onlyagame.org, or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science Boston, and the National Academy of Engineering, committed to promoting engineering and technological literacy in grades K-12 nationwide, mos.org/NCTL. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
"I was really fired up about jumping in, but it was really freezing," said Saori Yoshida. She was one of two Japanese wrestlers who decided to celebrate the start of 2008 by charging into the icy waters of Tokyo Bay. The New Year's Day swim was sponsored by Tokyo's bid committee, which is hoping to win the opportunity to host the 2016 Olympic Games. Another of the intrepid wrestlers, Kyoko Hamaguchi, said after the swim, "If you can handle that sort of cold, you can handle anything. It makes you feel you can beat anyone," which may or may not be as true as "it was really freezing." I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, hockey for competitors who want to avoid cold feet. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Are you ready for the weekend of football that will determine which teams get to play the Patriots, Cowboys, Packers, and Colts next weekend?
My card is indeed wild, Bill. It really is. I'm looking forward to seeing if the Washington Redskins, under pit crew boss coach Joe Gibbs, can, you know, stay on track. And I'm also interested in Jacksonville and Pittsburgh, since everybody seems to think Jacksonville has the best chance of derailing the Patriots. On the other side, can Tom Coughlin be fired for doing the right thing in the end of the year bowl when he and the Giants play against Tampa? So I honestly think that it'll be a fairly good weekend.
Well, that was going to be my one team-specific question regarding wild card weekend. Are the Giants as good as they looked against the Patriots last weekend?
Well, yeah, but they can no longer be as good as they looked against the Patriots because they lost four starters from the beginning of the game last week.
Right.
So I suspect that if they do manage to lose at Tampa Bay, which is certainly within the realm of possibility, Mr. Coughlin will get a lot of heat in New York for it.
Until this week, the Miami Dolphins had not fired a football coach, a head coach, in 37 years. What the heck did they break precedent for?
Because when you start off 0-13, it's a really deep hole to dig your way out of.
Even with a win.
They bring Bill Parcells in. He obviously wants his own people there. Cam Cameron never really had a chance.
Yeah, and Bill Parcells, as you say, now running the Dolphins. Bill Belichick again winning the AP's Coach of the Year Award up here in New England. Maybe those two old pals parlay their considerable resources. A reunion in the offing somewhere.
Well, actually, that seems to be a thawing of the ongoing Cold War between Bill Parcells and his former protege, which I think is probably a good thing for all concerned, although how long it will last if Bill Parcells makes a real run at members of Belichick's staff, most notably Josh McDaniel, we'll have to see.
This year has been the year of the upset in college football, Charlie. The BCS championship game, of course, takes place on Monday when number one Ohio State plays number two LSU. Can there be an upset in the biggest game of them all?
I would honestly make it an upset if Ohio State manages to stay within two touchdowns of LSU. I think they're going to get squashed. The only game they lost all year was to Illinois. Illinois' one great characteristic is that it's a very fast team. Illinois took all that speed and got drilled by Southern Cal in the Rose Bowl. And if Ohio State thinks Illinois was fast, they ain't seen nothing yet. There's no team in America faster than LSU. I think the game could be a real debacle by halftime.
On Wednesday night, Pat Summitt's Tennessee Vols demonstrated their strength by clobbering the number 15 team in the country, while Candace Parker spent the first half of the game on the bench. How many male coaches sit their best player for missing curfew?
Well, several of them do, but that assumes that the team has a curfew. There are very few men's teams that do.
The Boston Celtics own the NBA's best record, Charlie, but the hottest team has actually been the Portland Trail Blazers. I think they'll probably be very good next year, too. They got some guy named Oden who's going to be ready to join them then.
Yeah, that's right. He hasn't played yet. Brandon Roy is showing no signs of sophomore slump whatsoever after being the Rookie of the Year last year. They're coming up, however, on an 11-game and 13-night road trip, which will bring them to, among other places, Boston. That will be the testing ground on this team. I think they'll be back to earth a little bit by the time they get there.
That New Year's Day hockey game between the Penguins and the Sabres may have shown the National Hockey League where its future lies, or at least some are saying that. What do you think?
I thought it was a terrific idea. The people covering it seemed to have a tremendous time. The people playing it, the people watching it all had tremendous time. The snow, while it made for slow hockey, made for terrific video. Sidney Crosby won the game on a shootout goal on which he made somewhere between 5 and 8 moves in the last 3 feet before the net. I think it's probably a niche thing. I think it's probably a special occasion, but boy, it was a lot of fun.
Well, I just wonder how many times they're going to get 70,000 people to watch that if they do it, say, once a year.
Well, there are also only a few places where you can actually do that. You can't very well play, you know, in the Great Sombrero down in Tampa. You're not going to be seeing the Lightning playing there anytime soon. But I think you'll get a couple of these a year now.
This week, the attorneys representing Marion Jones argued that the federal judge before whom Ms. Jones will appear next week should be merciful. What is their case?
Well, their case is that she's already suffered the equivalence of being put in the stocks, basically, because of the distance she's fallen. What's really going to hang her up, though, is this whole check-kiting thing she did with Tim Montgomery. Judges may go lenient on you for using substances that they may think is general within your sport, but they don't like financial fraud at all. And to put that on top of the other is why I think Marion will be going to jail.
Tomorrow, noted friend of Roger, Mike Wallace, will interview Mr. Clemens on 60 Minutes. What do you anticipate?
I anticipate a formal denial which somehow skirts the issue of whether or not he can libel or slander Brian McNamee, whose testimony in the Mitchell report got Roger Clemens in this problem in the first place. I think it will be a McNamee said, Clemens said controversy all the way down the line.
But there is a piece of truth somewhere at the center of this, right?
Yes, there is.
They have agreed that injections occurred. It either was or wasn't an illicit substance.
Well, I mean, the only way you can judge is by the fact that McNamee's testimony to the Mitchell Commission seems to have a little bit of credibility in that Andy Pettit has admitted actually using HGH. I think this is Clemens' story, and I think he's sticking with it.
Okay, sports quiz time. It could be almost anybody, I guess, but what pro athlete this week characterized his treatment by his sports governing body as, quote, idiotic?
That would be Nikolai Davydenko, the alleged match dumper He's decided that the ATP investigation is idiotic. He doesn't like the way it's going because, damn it, it makes him look guilty.
It's altogether wrong.
He cannot be having an investigation where I look guilty. Something must be wrong.
And finally, we turn to the world of international diplomacy and the news that Diego Maradona wants to meet with the president of Iran. What do you suppose old Mano de Dios has in mind for Mr. Ahmadinejad?
He's already met with Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez. I think he's just out there meeting everyone who really doesn't like America.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. His recent book about Tom Brady is perhaps not so mysteriously selling brilliantly again, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
When LSU takes on Ohio State in Monday night's BCS championship game, it's fair to assume that their respective student bodies will pay attention. It's probably not a stretch to say that many of the athletes involved haven't been reading much in the past weeks, but it's not just the big schools with the bigger athletic programs that generate all the excitement. Only a Game's Karen Given has the story of a very different kind of school and its yearly obsession with a very different kind of sport.
If you take a walk down the hallways of the North Bennett Street School in Boston's North End, you're likely to stumble across an instructor in piano technology pounding out sour notes, or maybe a future violin builder stringing up his first instrument. But round the corner to the bookbinding department during the fall semester, and you'll see and hear something else entirely. For the past 10 years, the country's oldest trade school has been developing its varsity table hockey program. Why? Well, ask bookbinding instructor and athletic director Mark Anderson.
I came from Washington, University of Washington, where the football team is a little overly important to the rest of the school. And I came here and thought that we really can't be a legitimate secondary school without an athletic program that overwhelms the academic mission of the school. And I just thought that table hockey was the perfect way to achieve that.
Anderson's joking, of course. In fact, the whole tournament seems to be one big, completely obsessive, all-consuming joke. At the end of it all, the table hockey players, which this year included fully half the student body, receive and honor a bunch of 30-somethings with artistic leanings aren't likely to earn otherwise.
Oh, yeah. They each get a varsity letter and a crossed hockey stick pin. It's quite fun to walk around the building and people have their letters up over their benches. A couple of students sewed them on sweaters that they got and wore them around. But such is their pride that they have to display them every chance they get.
The real reason Anderson started the table hockey tournament was to give departments a chance to mingle. North Bennett Street students are largely on their second or third careers. They're highly motivated and not prone to waste a lot of time socializing. The table hockey tournament has succeeded at getting students to meet each other, but don't assume all that interaction is friendly.
Sometimes they'll shake the players at each other, but they're allowed to trash talk as long as they use terminology from their departments. I mean, it can be violent, but it has to be department specific.
Pound out his slug. Let's go, Paul.
Bring him up.
Oh.
The trash talking is generally met with giggles. While the earlier matches took place in the hallway, about 30 people have gathered inside the bookbinding department for this fifth round contest between Paul from violin building and Justin from preservation carpentry. As the game goes into sudden death overtime, the puck becomes lodged behind Paul's goalie and the crowd is overcome with excitement.
Think about this, Paul. No. No. To the left.
No.
To your right. To your right. No. Hit it to your right.
Do it. No.
With that, Paul Tromley's table hockey season is over. A few minutes later, he can be found at his workbench, patiently filing down a template for the rib structure of his latest violin. He says he's glad he lost. Now he can go back to focusing on his work. But before I can leave the violin department, Seth Gray calls my attention to the NBSS table hockey trophy.
Oh my goodness, it looks like the Stanley Cup.
Seth is a slight guy who doesn't much resemble the plastic-molded hockey players he controls. But despite his peaceful demeanor, he's definitely the most creative of the violin builders when it comes to department-specific trash talk.
Bend your ribs, cut your F-holes, set the neck, trim his button, ream out his peg holes.
String him up.
Yeah, string him up. Gouge out his eyes. That one's a good one.
Wait, do you actually gouge out eyes?
Yeah, the eyes on the scroll. You could use a gouge. You could use a knife, too, so knife out his eyes would be just as gruesome.
While the violin builders have taken the trophy 6 times in the past 10 years, a jewelry maker has yet to win. Sitting at a small work desk and surrounded by glittering metals, Joe Balboni doesn't look like a jewelry maker. In fact, he looks an awful lot like a hockey player. And when I ask him why he signed up for the tournament, I discover he talks like a hockey player, too.
What's fun about it? It's table hockey. It's the tournament. It's the tournament of the year. What do they say? All work and no play makes Joe a dull boy.
Joe jokes, but Miguel Gomez Ibanez, executive director of the North Bennett Street School, says that's sort of the point of the tournament.
The students get here at 8 o'clock and they leave here as late as they possibly can. We don't have truancy problems. In fact, we have the opposite. We have to kick people out. It's a very physical school. We're all working all day with our hands. And so we needed an athletic endeavor to complement it. And we needed one with probably as little physical component as possible. So we needed an intellectual game.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light.
3 weeks later, it seems like the entire school has gathered in the piano technology department for the final. The pianos have been pushed into the far corners, and a projection screen is set up to display all the action. As the national anthem concludes, the North Bennett Street School Air Force launches its annual flyover. But most of the paper airplanes don't make it more than a few feet before crashing to the ground. Before he drops the puck, Mark Anderson has one last thought for the participants.
But I have something very sad to say that you guys don't know, and that is, having played in this tournament and won your letter and gotten your jacket, nothing in your life is ever going to equal this again. And I'm so sorry, because, you know, people have had children after this, and their wife says, here's your daughter, and they go, you know, this is nice, but table hockey, you know? But thank you all for playing, and thank you for putting the school on the map. Who wants to be USC when you can be North Bennett Street School?
With that, jewelry maker Joe Balboni is pitted against violin builder Seth Gray. From the start, it's clear that the jewelry makers have a good shot at winning their first championship. After a 3-minute half, which is, quite frankly, the longest anyone can be expected to watch two inexperienced players trying to remember which stick controls which little plastic man, Walter McDonald of McDonald Halftime Productions LLC steps in to lead the halftime sing-along, a stirring tribute to Mark Anderson, who's leaving the school after 10 years.
Sung this song and I'll sing it again. Mark gave us this game and taught us to grin at hockey and binding now every day. And here's what all of the people here say. It's so long, it's been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you.
There's hardly a dry eye in the house as Anderson drops the puck for the second half.
Ready?
Say when?
Go!
The second half doesn't go much better for Seth. As the crowd counts down to 0, he frantically shoots the puck with disappointing results.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
With that, Joe Balboni is presented with the newly renamed Anderson Cup, which he hoists over his head like a true champion. It doesn't take long for the students to dissipate, back to their workbenches and the tasks at hand, many of them relieved that the distraction is over for another year. Though he's losing his athletic director, Miguel Gomez Ibanez isn't worried about the strength of his table hockey program.
We don't believe we have any competition, but if anyone were to contact us and dare to challenge us, we'd be happy to. Well, there's no polite way to say what we'd do to them.
You might set their necks.
Exactly, exactly, exactly.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
When the telephone rang that very first fall, I heard it was Mark making a call. This hockey's for everyone, give it a try. Now after 10 turnies, we understand why it's so long.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Bill Estes at WHAD in Milwaukee. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Karen Given's table hockey photo gallery or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from former North Bennett Street School bookbinding instructor and athletic director Mark Anderson, who comments on why the school's table hockey players are forbidden from engaging in non-departmental trash talk.
Otherwise, you just have chaos. It would become the NHL, and as delightful as that is, it doesn't have the same charm as the North Bennett Street table hockey athletic program.
Well, the NHL had the sort of charm of which Mr. Anderson speaks, not to mention the skill level of the North Bennett Street craftsmen and women. It might not have to resort to outdoor hockey games or to on-ice felonies. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.
One more time! So long, it's been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. That the desert is calling to be your new home. And we're sorry you're moving along. All right, Mark.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.